So there's a teaching that appears in a number of places in the history of Buddhism. It keeps popping up from here to there, here and there. And most recently in the lineage of our mindfulness tradition coming from Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah said once that everything occurs within the heart. Kind of like a secret or kind of key little teaching. That everything occurs within the heart. And, you know, it's one of these many kinds of pithy statements, kernels of statements that kind of tries to encapsulate some of the essential aspect of Buddhism or Buddhist practice. And I find it very touching, this teaching. Everything occurs within the heart. Another variation of this teaching is the one that says, don't exclude anything from your heart. Don't keep anything out of your heart. But the first people will say, you can't really do that. Because everything happens within the heart, whether you realize it or not. Now, the word that's translated as heart into English is the word citta. And citta is a little bit ambivalent word in that it could equally well be translated as mind. In a number of Asian languages, Buddhist Asian languages, the word for heart and mind is often the same. And so you could say everything occurs within the mind. But I think that that lends itself too easily to unfortunate associations for many people in the West, where the mind maybe is the thinking mind or the ruminating mind, or you know, I don't know what we think about the mind is. And the heart, you know, has a different association. It's not so cognitive or analytical, or as maybe the mind might appear. But both aspects, I think, work equally well. Talking about don't exclude anything from the heart or the mind. Everything occurs within the heart and the mind. So I want to talk about a little bit about these two aspects of the word citta. And so the first thing is everything occurs within the mind. The mind, in this context, tends to mean not the functioning of the mind in its details, but rather the broader frame of mind within which we, the mind functions or psyche functions. The broader kind of frame or the container that holds our experience of the world. And often people will point to consciousness or awareness as being this citta. And so when Ajahn Chah says nothing, everything occurs within the citta, it could be understood as everything occurs within awareness. And we have a lot of people who, kind of more in a mystical kind of vein perhaps, would like to point out that our whole experience of the world, our direct experience of the world, not the imagined or read about or whatever, the whole immediate experience of the world happens within the sphere of our perceptions. And so that whatever we're looking at, it happens within the sphere of what we perceive. And so it's within the sphere of our awareness. Where does our awareness reside? Does our awareness reside in here, with behind the eyes? Or does it reside somehow in the broader sphere of the things that we're aware of? And some people will say that, well, clearly, you know, physiologically, awareness happens in here, behind the eyes, and somehow in the neurons that travel to the brain. But some people point out that there's a way of experiencing the world where it seems as if awareness is broader than the limits of our body, that awareness it goes to extends out to the objects that awareness, that perception perceives. So if you see a person, that person can be seen as distinct from you out there, or it can be seen within the sphere of your awareness, that the awareness extends out there. It's broader than the limits of your body. Some people report in concentrated states or altered states of various times, that the sense of them as an individual disappear, and who they are becomes what they're looking at. The famous poem, Chinese poem, that goes something like, First there was me and the mountain, and then I disappeared and all that was left was the mountain. Or some people talk about becoming one with something. And the feeling of you kind of disappear, just that experience there becomes who we are. The sense or the perception of perception is a kind of alterable thing. It's not a fixed thing, how we perceive things. How we perceive any experience at all is filtered through various frames of mind, various understandings of what it means to perceive. And if we just take the given way of perceiving as the only way of perceiving, then we limit the possibility of various ways of perceiving this experience of life itself. And part of the function of Buddhist practice is to begin in a healthy and wise way to expand the variety of ways in which we allow ourselves to perceive this world that we're in. So it's not just simply, you know, one way, I'm here and you're there. But there's also, I'm there and you're here. Or other ways that... And it isn't so much a matter of necessarily of constructing this kind of view or manufacturing it, but sometimes when the mind gets very, very deeply relaxed, then sometimes a normal perception of how we engage in the world is altered, or changes, or relaxes also. So everything occurs within the mind. So there's all kinds of interesting questions that are sometimes mind-bending. One question is your mind within your body, or is your body within your mind? What do you think? Which do you give priority to? Someone?
I'm in the body.
Your mind is in your body?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of subset of the body? Someone else? Yes?
Mm-hmm.
So the body is a subset of the mind, maybe? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How would you know that? Mm-hmm. And how would you know yours? And so one answer here was using logic in a sense, and the other answer was using your sense of how it is. And I'm not going to suggest that either one is right or wrong. But it's using different kind of logic or different kind of different orientation to come to an answer to that question. And depending on how we engage in this world, or what senses or what logic we kind of use for it. This idea that everything occurs within the mind or within the heart is not meant to be a literally true statement, you know, a scientific statement or something. It's meant, I think, to be kind of a sense or a felt sense or a way of experiencing that can be helpful or can describe a certain way of being in the world. I have friends, teachers, who like to ask the question, are you in this room or is this room in you? And a little bit when you say the room's in you, they're pointing to the idea that your experience of this room, physically you're inside the room, but your experience of the room, the experiencing of this room itself as an experience, happens within the sphere of your awareness. How awareness is registered in the eyes and in the brain, and the field of awareness itself. And so there's a way in saying that this room occurs within the mind, within awareness. Even though we don't want to say it's literally true, perhaps. Another way of asking these kinds of questions is to ask, where does the mind rest? What's the focus or the foci for the attention of the mind? And often it's with the objects of awareness, where we're listening to words and we're focusing on the words, or we're looking at an object and we're focusing on that object, or we're thinking and we're focusing on our thoughts or our preoccupations. We have feelings, we focus on those feelings. And often awareness is focusing on objects of awareness. And that seems like a completely innocent thing to do, the obvious thing to do, to focus on. But there's another half to what awareness is. There's the objects of awareness, and then there's the awareness that is aware. And some people point out that awareness can exist independent of the objects of awareness. Or that's, there's a sense that awareness can exist, feel like it's very broad and spacious. And then objects just arise into that awareness. One image of this is that of clouds in an endless sky, kind of clouds drifting peacefully and easily in a sky. So in the same way, objects of awareness arise in awareness, and they float there and rise and float through. And that's one possibility. That's one way in which the psyche can be. It can be very relaxed and open and soft and not fixating on anything. And it can seem like sounds and thoughts and feelings just arise and flow through. Another way of being with the objects of awareness is to fixate on them. And I think anybody who does a little bit of mindfulness training practice will realize to a great extent to which the mind, the awareness, our psyche kind of fixates on things. Gets pulled around maybe by the objects, or gets preoccupied, or kind of compulsiveness to kind of trying to solve things or think about things or review the past or plan the future. Or kind of heightened awareness of the environment because we're maybe worried, we're trying to make sure we're safe, or maybe we're ambitious, we have desires. We're going down the street and we're looking at stores, always fixating on the store that might have the latest Palm Pilot. You know, and so we're just looking for Palm Pilot stores and the mind's fixated. And the mind is often very concerned about things, wanting things to be a certain way or fixing things. And so that's one way of being. And there's other ways of being, and that is to let go of that fixation of the mind and have the mind rest in itself rather than focusing or resting in the objects. So the mind that rests in itself, then the world seems to just arise within the mind, is one way that it's described. This idea of the sense of the world existing within the mind, within our awareness, our experienced world, the world that we experience exists within the sphere of how we experience, or our perceptions. And I don't know if this works for you, but a little exercise that kind of opens my mind in a certain sense is if I try to see what is behind my eyes, I just get the sense immediately of infinite space. I don't know, maybe it's for other people it's different. Maybe it's blank or nothing or something. I don't know what it would be. But for me, I kind of look behind my eyes, see what's behind my eyes. And it's, you know, it seems like just infinite space. It seems very spacious, very broad. What is that? What is all that back there? The idea of everything occurring within the mind. There's a thing that happens on retreats that I often talk about that points to this. Is on retreats, things are not always optimal. And we would like things to be perfect on retreats. And just like we'd like maybe things to be perfect in life. And just like in life, things are not optimal, it seems to be that retreats are not optimal. And sometimes I've been accused of ensuring that retreats are not optimal. But I've never done this intentionally. But it's very important, I think, that retreats not be too optimal, because there's things to be learned. And when we up against that interface between our ideals, how we think we should think, how we want things to be, and how things actually are. And so one common experience on retreats is someone will come to interview and say some variety of, "You have to do something about that person sitting next to me. The person is... you know, you can't believe what this person is like. The person always comes in late. They have a lumberjack way of walking into the meditation hall late. Bah, 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 the whole." And then the person sits down next to me. And I don't know, the person must have been running a marathon, because in the next 10 minutes, the person's breathing really hard. And then at some point, the person decides to take off his or her Velcro coat and just rips it off. And then, after a few minutes later, the person has to blow the nose and then starts moving around and then gets up, sits in the chair right behind me, and this, you know, and this person is making all this noise. And this is not, it's disrespectful of me. I'm sitting here, I'm on the verge of my enlightenment. And this is the one thing that's in the way. And you have to do something about that person. And so teachers will, like myself, will usually kind of nod appreciatively, understandingly, and say, oh, okay. And maybe you should go back and kind of investigate that some more, or look at that, or take this as an opportunity of practice. We just say it very carefully so they don't punch us out. Maybe you should, you know, look at this, and, you know. And maybe we tell them something about it, you know, about how to work with it and look at it. And then what happens often is some days later, the person, especially if the retreat's long enough so they can really work through it, they'll come back and say, oh, I'm no longer troubled by all that noise, because now it doesn't seem like the noise is outside of me. It's just noise passing through. And before, that noise and that sound, when it came to my ears and in my mind, was met with all kinds of attitudes. That noise is out there. That noise is interfering with me. I have these agenda, these things I'm trying to do, and this gets in the way. I have ideas about who I am and what being respected is, and this person, and what other people's behavior is like. And all these attitudes and ideas are wrapped into that experience of hearing that sound. It's not just an innocent hearing of Velcro coats being, you know, ripped open. And as the mind begins to relax and is not prone to kind of be activated with all these attitudes and ideas and dropping all this extra stuff, then even the sound of a Velcro coat or someone blowing their nose or whatever can just be like a breeze going through, like a sound of a bird chirping outside. It just passes through and doesn't have to meet anything. And the mind stays open and relaxed, and it doesn't disturb the peace of the mind. It doesn't create any waves or ripples in the surface of the mind. It just sound, you know, clouds going through the endless sky. So in a sense, what they're reporting is that they're no longer treating that sound as something outside the mind. It's now included within the mind. It occurs within the mind, and the mind is not ruffled by it. And if we're limiting ourselves to what we think is scientifically true, we might be limiting the possibilities of how the mind can relax or how the mind can be at peace with itself. But if we kind of broaden the view of what is going on right now to hold the idea that everything occurs within the mind, then maybe that allows a chance for the awareness to relax enough so there is no outside, in a sense. And when there's no outside, the hope is, in Buddhist practice, that we relate to the objects of awareness without clinging, without either trying to push it away or contracting around it, holding on to it. The movement of contraction in the mind, the movement of resistance in the mind, is one of the primary movements that Buddhist practice is trying to free us from. And as a mind which just holds things kind of within the endless sky of the mind is one then which is not for or against objects, but objects arise in the mind and they're just there. Part of the challenge of doing this, of letting things be, giving things the freedom just be as they are, and not contracting the mind around things or resisting things, is to have some kind of deep trust or faith or wisdom of trusting what emerges, or trusting our innate intelligence, allowing things just to arise somewhat freely, and have some sense that it's okay to let things just be there, that how we respond to it will be wise. Somehow how we respond to it will be wise enough that we can take care of ourselves in that kind of situations. We can speak what is true. And in speaking what is true, perhaps we can take care of us. We don't have to always plan ahead, plan our conversations. We don't always have to protect ourselves and defend who we think we are. We can just be transparent in some way in this transparent mind. And that the transparent mind, just like the clouds drift up freely into the mind, so our responses to the world, how we act and say, we say, can arise also, can bubble up by itself also in that endless mind, that open mind. And I think the maturing of Buddhist practice involves a kind of maturing of this kind of trust, that we don't have to always plan or think ahead or defend, or that we don't have to be anything for anybody, and we can just somehow be ourselves in a more complete way, be ourselves freely. If we can't be ourselves, then Buddhism can't be Buddhism. There is no Buddhism unless we are ourselves first. And so have some kind of faith in that or trust that we can relax into that. So nothing occurs, everything occurs within the mind, is one way of translating into English this phrase of Ajahn Chah. The other way of translating into English is that everything occurs within the heart. And I like this formulation of it because the heart is a seat of love or kind of emotions, of warm emotions. The mind can lend itself to a kind of disembodied spirituality. Or you talk about endless awareness and awareness which open includes everything, but it's transparent. It kind of lends itself to kind of focusing on something ethereal almost, something that's not quite there, kind of the emptiness of the mind or the clarity of the mind. And whereas the heart, we're talking about something very different, we're talking, in a sense, or pointing towards something, for us in the West at least. The heart is the seat of wholeheartedness or warm-heartedness or heartfelt qualities of love or compassion or caring for others. And when we say everything occurs within the heart or don't exclude anything from your heart, it implies a little bit different feeling for me than the idea of everything occurs within the mind. Don't turn anybody away from your heart. Keep everybody within your heart. No one should be excluded from your heart, from your care, from your concern, from your respect. On Friday, we've had here a day long on loving kindness practice, which is one expression of this heart. And one of the things that strikes me is that most people, if we take the time to really be present for someone else, to pause long enough to take them in as a human being, that I think that heartfelt qualities of understanding, appreciation of that person have a chance to surface and arise. So the example I used was that of going to the market and shopping. And if we kind of judge the shopping, the checkout clerk superficially, we can have a very quick superficial take of who they are and treat them that way. And we're waiting in line, the person in front of us is being checked out. The clerk is going too slow. And, doesn't this clerk realize I have important places to go to and important things to do? And how could they be so slow and so sloppy? And how could the store have hired someone who's so slow? And we kind of have this quick attitude or judgments about who they are. But if you really kind of stood in front of the person and really looked at them and took them in and really paused and dropped kind of surface judgment, you pick up something different from them. You see their humanity. You see, oh, here's a person perhaps who has sorrows and joys and challenges just like you do. Someone perhaps who is struggling in various ways in their life or has a capacity for joy and happiness. And at least, for me, if I pause long enough and take in the humanity of someone, my heartfelt connection to them begins to grow. The longer that pauses, the stronger that sense is. Maybe some of you have done the kind of exercises where you have dyads and you sit and you just sit with someone in silence for 10 minutes and just look with them, be with them. Look at their eyes, look at their chest, just kind of take in that person in silence for 10 minutes. And I've done that a number of times, and after 10 minutes I'm in love with the person. I have a much deeper sense of heartfelt connection probably than it would if I talked to that person for 10 minutes. If we pause and allow ourselves to be present for another person as a person, the suggestion I have is that we give a chance for heartfelt qualities of connectedness to arise. That won't happen if we don't pause. If we carry on a monologue or interrupt someone, it's most important to say what we think is important to say in the conversation, and don't really take the time to receive and take the other person as a person, then we shortchange the opportunity for this heartfelt connection to arise. The suggestion I like to make is that if we take enough time to pause and take in the humanity of someone else, everybody, no matter who, will elicit some kind of heartfelt warmth or love or care for. My suggestion is even some of this, a really horrible person, Idi Amin. If you came across Idi Amin in jail and no one had fed him for 3 or 4 days and he was just in a miserable state, and you had next to a loaf of bread. Maybe you would kind of, okay, it's kind of a basic human thing to offer this person, some food or, something. You don't want that person just to suffer unnecessarily. I hope that's the case. Though in other circumstances, you might treat that person differently. But in certain circumstances, your heartfelt connection would be as part of who we are. It's said that the proximate cause for the arising of loving kindness is seeing the loveliness in other people. I think that's a beautiful statement, to see the loveliness in others. Have you ever taken the time to look into other people and see their loveliness? Is it there in other people? Do you believe it's there for strangers and people you don't know and people you don't like? Is it in people you don't like? What is it that's lovely? What do you look for? What do you see when you see the loveliness in other people? The proximate cause of compassion, which is a different form of love, is seeing the suffering in people. And then the question is, how is a wise way of receiving or seeing suffering in others? Is healthy forms of love a matter of who the other people are, or is it more a matter of who you are? And often the way people fall in love, it's many times about the other person. The other person has just the right kind of hair, whatever. Something about the person, I'll tell you a little, just occurs to me as I say, he's sitting here. I once fell in love with a woman during a sesshin, during a Zen retreat, because she was sitting next to me. And I fell in love with the way she breathed. We spent 7 days, breathing together. I was aware of her breath. So that was nice. And the relationship worked out okay for a while. But, is it about something about the other person? It certainly is if you see the loveliness in someone else. But there's also something very important about who we are. Are we a person who has paused long enough? Are we a person who's been open enough to really see the other person? Are we the kind of person who's not preoccupied so much by our fears, our thoughts, our concerns, that we are available to see the loveliness in other people or the suffering of others? And I would like to suggest that it's more about how we are than about how other people are. The whole thing of love, at least love in terms of the Buddhist form of loving kindness and compassion, sympathetic joy and equanimity. Both are true, but what we have the most chance to work with is ourselves. We can be someone different. How we are is something we can change and work with. How other people are, we maybe try to change them, but I don't know how useful that can be. Or I know plenty of people, including myself at times, that sometimes there's a hesitation to take in another person as a human being, as a huge, full human being, or be paused long enough to really see them honestly or fully, or so there's kind of a heartfelt quality arises. Because the concern is if I do that, other things will follow. If I do that, then I'm going to have to invite the person home to dinner, or this person's going to ask me for a favor, or this person's going to just not want to leave me alone. It's going to, don't want to talk to me, and I'm in a hurry, or something. And some fear that that there are unnecessary or unwanted consequences from opening up to someone else. And at times there can be that. But what I'd like to suggest is that there are ways of living wisely while keeping our hearts open, while including everyone in our hearts. There are wise ways of saying, no, not now. I can't do that. I'm here for you, I'm present, but I can't bring you home for dinner, or I can't do this favor for you. Learning to take care of ourselves, learning to set limits is part of what allows us to keep our hearts open. The famous story, maybe it's been told too many times, but the famous story I think it was one of the Vipassana teachers when she was young. She was practicing in India, and some guy tried to accost her in the streets of India, and she fended him off and went back to her teacher and said, you're teaching me all this loving kindness practice and how to be kind and everything. And here I was accosted by this guy. How should I be? What should I do? And the teacher said, with all the loving kindness you can muster for this person, hit him over the head with your umbrella. So, you know, I don't know if that was the wisest answer either, but it points to the idea that that there are perhaps ways of taking care of ourselves. It doesn't require us shutting down our hearts. So everything occurs within the heart is a statement of how things are, in a sense. And then the practice issue is, are there ways in which we exclude things from our heart or exclude things from our mind? Do we create a division? And if so, is that division or that separation or those barriers, are they healthy for us? Are they wise? Or do they cause suffering? And the chances are that most of the kind of sense of separation, the kind of exclusion, when we exclude something from our minds, exclude something from our hearts, this is unacceptable, I'm not going to open to this, I'm not going to be aware of this. When we do that, we just add suffering. It's like adding salt to a wound. It might seem like it's useful to do, but in the long term, it doesn't really lead to our liberation, to our freedom. It doesn't lead to the maturing of this good heart that is within all of us. So the practice issue then is, how do we begin understanding how we exclude things, and how do we work with that, and how do we begin to relax it so we can bring things in or include things, not leave things outside, not leaving anything outside. And as I say often in the introductory course that I teach, that what is most sacred for Buddhists is that awareness which has nothing outside. When there's no outside, when everything's included within, that is what's sacred. As soon as we have inside and outside, what is acceptable for awareness and what is not, what we're willing to open our hearts for and what we're not willing, then we're no longer in touch with that which is most sacred, with the sacred realm. So everything occurs within the heart. Everything occurs within the mind. And I think my belief or my sense is everyone will have this experience if we relax deeply and remain alert. So those are my thoughts for this morning. Do you have any thoughts in reply or comments or questions? Please.
I've been struggling with this very issue and so that kind of head, and I'm still struggling with the idea if, in fact, you know, everything is as it is, and that's the reality, then if I'm unable to be around someone who is something that I find to be abrasive or narrow-minded or just a difficult personality, am I not practicing, you know, the deepest, best practice that I can have by not being able to continue any kind of an association with someone who, mm-hmm. you know, feel like I'm being abrasive?
Good question. So the question is, if she's not able to be around people who are difficult and abrasive to be around, is she not practicing her deepest, you know, not fulfilling the deepest forms of practice, and something wrong with her? Is that kind of? Or
do you want to? Yeah, no, that is. And it's like, what can I do? I mean, am I supposed to just accept that, you know, that he is what he is?
And if you have a headache when you're with this person.
Yeah.
Nothing's outside the mind, including the headache.
That issue of the boundaries. Okay, yeah. Well, you know, I can have compassion for this person, but yeah. I don't have to be in a relationship with them.
Right, that seems right. I mean, a part of what's included within the kind of the accepting awareness is our limitations and the ways in which we do cling or resist or contract. And so there has to be a very wise approach towards our so-called limitations or the places where we do cling. If we set up as some kind of ideal, I'm supposed to be open to everyone and, you know, some kind of idealistic way, and we're not that way, and we criticize ourselves for it, then we're going against the grain or the current of what the practice is trying to do for us. And so you want to be very careful how you hold ideals. But if you see the ideal and see it as a kind of highlighting how you actually are, and then you realize, oh, I'm supposed to accept how I am too. These are my limitations, and I have to work with this. And if I stay in proximity to this person in a certain way, I just end up with this horrible headache. It doesn't work for me. And I think what I need is to titrate how I am with this person, you know, moderate this, be with only occasionally, or I need to go away for a few months or a few years until I work on my own reactivity or something. I think knowing, having a strong sense of one's own limitations and taking that seriously into account is a very important part of a wise life. And not to override it because it's not what deep practice is supposed to look like. Deep practice occurs at the juncture of who you are, not beyond that. So there's that. And then... I'm not sure. Asking that question is a great question. Exploring for yourself the answer, I think, is very, very important. And mostly I'd encourage you to keep asking the question, exploring it. I do know that it's important to know, to pay attention to the consequences of our activities, our actions, and what we do. If the consequences of reading the paper too many times or too much of it is our heart closes or we feel depressed, and then probably it's not useful to read the paper so much. Unless you really have a strong sense that that you can really somehow practice, you know, you can engage in a practice way with your reactivity to what's happening when you're reading the paper. So you're working that edge so that you can understand, you know, is it fear that's causing it? Is it, what's the nature of that distress? Then it's okay to kind of ride the edge and see what's happening. But if you find yourself kind of drowning, then we need to kind of figure out how to take care of ourselves. And sometimes reading a paper less and will help us keep our hearts open. But if we only protect ourselves from having our hearts kind of close up, then it maybe is not so realistic in terms of practice. In a sense, one way of understanding practice is practice. Real practice occurs as a practice is at that juncture between, that juncture where we start contracting. If we think we're supposed to just kind of be spiritual people and just relax into the big mind and that's where we're supposed to live all the time, that's nice. I mean, it'd be great if you could. Just, you know, I can snap my fingers and all of us can just live there, right? That'd be great. But that's not where practice is. And one of the most precious things we have is practice. And practice occurs a little bit at the interface between maybe the big mind and the small mind, or the place where we're contracted and places where we're not. So it's, you know, so you might want to kind of not read the full paper, but read just enough so you can kind of begin kind of exploring that edge and start understanding what's going on within you with this experience. What is it that gets triggered inside of you? And as you understand yourself better, then maybe there's less reactivity and you're able to be open more fully. Yeah.
I mean, only in the sense that, you know, when you think about situations that go on in the world where you really wish that you could do something else and other people that are suffering, sometimes it's easy that the metta practice seems to help to ease that.
Sure. Metta practice can help a lot. Compassion practice can help. There's a lot of practices that can help. And those are really great to do. And it's important also to have the willingness at times and the ability at times to just have a broken heart. And part of practice I think is part of having a heart that includes everything, is to have a heart that also is willing to be hurt or feel pain. And if you have an okay with it, okayness with that, we're not expected to have a heart that's always blissed out or joyed or relaxed. That I think a healthy heart is one that at times feels pain, feels suffering, or feels the pain of the world is broken in some ways by what happens in the world, and doesn't try to resist that or run away from that, or it's just part of what one of the clouds that drifts through the endless sky. My heart gets broken a lot. So you might try today, as you go about your day, to pause long enough to see if you can get a sense of things in a different way than how you usually sense or experience your life. Maybe pause long enough to see if there's some way that you can include this experience in your heart. Or pause long enough, is there some way that you can include this within your awareness, in your mind? Or pause long enough to realize that maybe it's all occurring within this big mind. So thank you all. And if anything today didn't make any sense to you, then just leave it here. Leave it in my mind. I'll keep it.